6. It's overcast, 48 degrees Kenosha, 46 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, viewers can watch a very, very interesting film, which is called The Sun Queen. And The Sun Queen tells the story of an extraordinary woman whom I knew absolutely nothing about, and I'm amazed that I knew nothing about one Maria Talkisch, who was a visionary scientist working extensively in the field of solar energy. And she was, for a time, very, very well known. And there are all kinds of circumstances under which the groundbreaking work that she did in solar energy never quite took hold, never reached the fruition which her ideas perhaps merited. And only now are we perhaps coming to a fuller appreciation of just what she did and the kind of forces that stood in her way in terms of allowing her full access to resources that might have allowed her to take her groundbreaking work even further. This American Experience film, airing tomorrow night, called The Sun Queen, tells the story of Maria Talkisch. And I'm so excited to be able to speak with a gifted woman who is both producer and director of the film, Amanda Pollack, who over the years has created some 15 films for the PBS series American Experience. I'm sure many of you saw the massive and engrossing six-part series called The Great War, which talked about America's involvement in World War I. Her American Experience films include also a biography of William Randolph Hearst, The Road to Memphis, Spacemen, The Big Burn, and many, many more. And again, her most recent film, which airs tomorrow night, is called The Sun Queen. Amanda Pollack, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
So I readily admit to not having ever heard of Maria Talkisch before. I would probably be embarrassed to admit that, except I have a feeling I'm far from alone.
And of course, good company, I would say.
Yes. I mean, that's actually kind of one of the central themes of your film, is that this was an important woman who did important work that was very quickly, in a sense, swallowed up in undeserved obscurity. Her name is just now again coming to light. Tell us how you came to know the name of Maria Talkisch and her story.
Yes, well, like you and like many of your audience members, I'm sure, I also had never heard of Maria Talkisch when I began this project. American Experience had done some research and had kind of decided that they wanted to make this film, and they approached us about it. And my collaborator, writer and producer Gene Tempest, and I delved into her story. And I have to say, it was a different kind of experience, because as you mentioned, so many of the films that I've made have been about these kind of quote-unquote big American stories, the Great War or a biography of William Randolph Hearst, who, is a fairly household name. But Maria Talkisch was not somebody that I knew about, and it also meant that it presented certain challenges. There weren't a lot of people to obviously interview about her. There wasn't the great biography of her that we could turn to, or the archive that, you know, everyone knew about and lots of material had been collected in. And so it was at first a little bit daunting. We were sort of, how do we go about this? How do we tell this story when we don't necessarily have the obvious resources to do it the way we've done it before? But I have to say it turned into one of my favorite films to make, because it really was this exploration and you know, forced us to sort of come at her story from different angles in terms of finding people in the journalist community, in the architecture community, who maybe knew just a small slice of her story and could help us paint the portrait. And it was a really interesting experience. And I think it also, you know, it certainly made us think a lot about, you know, how history kind of continues, and when there aren't those resources that make it easier to tell somebody's story, it then makes it a lot less likely that those stories get told. And I think that that's one of many reasons why Maria Telkisch is not a household name, because she kind of didn't get that attention from the historians or from the journalist community, you know, in the last several decades.
Right. And what's interesting, too, is sometimes people are not remembered because they were never famous. They were never prominent. I mean, and mm-hmm. maybe deserved to be, mm-hmm. but for whatever reason were kind of shut out of the limelight. And that's actually not the case with Maria Telkisch. There was a time when she was quite well known, and I suppose that's valuable for you, in that because she was prominent for a time, made a splash, there is a decent amount of material that remains, including a fair amount of film footage and so on, which captures her story, and which gives you some tools by which to tell this story so very, very well.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, she was a really big deal, and she was also a masterful public relations person. She really knew how to sell her story. She knew how to sell what she was trying to do. And a lot of the material that we ended up finding for the film was press. I mean, we worked a lot with newspaper articles and photographs of her from newspapers of the time, because that was where we really found the treasure trove. And even the title, The Sun Queen, comes from a headline from the time.
We're speaking with Amanda Pollack, who is producer and director of the American Experience film The Sun Queen, which airs tomorrow night on PBS. It tells the story of one Maria Telkisch, a scientist actually born and raised in Hungary, who emigrates to the United States in the early 1930s and quickly finds a very prominent place in what I would regard as the surprisingly wide and important field of alternative energy. I think one of the things that I took away from your film, aside from learning about this fascinating woman, is also that the history of solar energy, especially here in the United States, is a much longer history than I ever would have dreamt. If I understood correctly, your film actually tells us about very serious efforts already in the late 19th century involving solar energy. I had no idea that that experiments were already going on at that early date. I suspect maybe that was something that was unknown to you as well. Just briefly, sketch kind of the significance of some of these early efforts with solar energy. I mean, why such experiments were taking place at all at that point in time, and kind of how Maria Telkisch fits into that long arc.
Yes. You know, we're obviously hyper aware at this particular moment about the delicacy of our relationship with the environment and the need to find alternative energy sources. And it's a hot topic, and solar is a hot topic today. But what is really striking and also a little bit scary to me is that we were having these conversations over 100 years ago as well. We see images of solar panels on rooftops in the 1880s. There were solar water heaters installed in houses across America, in the 1910s, 20s, 30s. And really, if you think about it, at that time, industrialization was going strong, and there was a sense of how are we going to fuel this growing economy, this growing society that we have. And there was a realization that that we needed to look to any means possible, and that the idea of harnessing the power of the sun in order to help fuel the society that we were building made all the sense in the world. And so people were thinking about these things and focusing on solar all the way back then. And there was this sense of scarcity, this sense that we really do need to think creatively or conserve in some ways. And that really goes all the way up through World War II. And so that, she grew up, she was born in 1900 in Hungary, and she was highly educated. She got a PhD in chemistry in Hungary, and then comes to the United States with her eye on this issue of solar. She just, from a very early age, was passionate about the idea that we needed to harness the power of the sun in order to provide clean energy and more abundant energy. And she really has the sort of wind at her back in terms of the momentum of what was going on around her in terms of this belief that, that this was something that was a worthy scientific endeavor. And MIT created something called the Solar Fund, and she ended up getting a job there working on this question of, how can we harness the sun in order to power the things that we want to do. But really, it was not a novel idea in some ways at that time, which is really, really striking.
Yeah, no kidding. One of the central themes of your film is about this solar project and the other scientists at MIT with which Maria Talkish worked and with whom she experienced a fair amount of tension and friction. And of course, we get the sense, and it's probably understandable, that in this male-dominated world, somebody like Maria Talkish might not necessarily be welcomed with open arms. What did you find most striking about this aspect of Maria Talkish's story? That is, the problematic relationship that she had with the men at MIT over the course of some years.
Yeah, I think in some ways it's no surprise that she faced the resistance from her male colleagues. You look at some of the documentation, some of the reports that were filed when she was let go of MIT, which is what eventually happened, and it's really atrocious. The way that they describe her and sort of her aggressive tendencies, or she's too assertive. And you realize that, as one of our interviewees, Sarah Shreve Price, says, all of the very qualities that got her to where she was, which was really this incredibly strong vision and passion and commitment to what she was doing, were also qualities that really rubbed her male colleagues the wrong way, because I think they didn't, that's not what was expected of women at that time. And they really did a lot to stand in her way. And one of the things, I guess, that really struck me about it, not so much that is surprising, especially, thinking back to the 1940s when she was there. But, science is all about experimentation. And so much of experimentation is failure. And so it is completely normal that you would have to experiment and fail again and again and again in order to accomplish whatever you're trying to do. And I think what is notable about Maria Telkisch and her time at MIT is that she really wasn't allowed to fail. Her male colleagues just seized upon every moment where things didn't go exactly as she would have wanted them to, and used that as a way to sideline her and ultimately to fire her. And, you know, if you just think about who is given the opportunity to fail in this world and who is not, that really, I think, tells a lot about, you know, who ultimately gets the credit for things. And I think that people like Maria Telkisch wasn't really allowed to fail and then ultimately, you know, has not been fully recognized for her work as a result.
If I remember correctly, one of the things said in the film is that Maria Telkisch was maybe different from at least many of her colleagues at MIT in sort of the purpose behind her work on solar energy, that while many of them were, in a sense, kind of dealing with the scientific abstract of it all, the abstract concepts, she was really thinking about the lives of people and how this could change the way people lived and could vastly improve the way people lived in the world, to say nothing of the way in which, of course, our environment would be benefited greatly by us turning to energy sources like solar. And towards that end, one of the things that was nearest and dearest to her heart was to create some kind of a home in which solar power would be essentially used for everything, and something which could kind of stand as a beacon for what would be possible. And of course, central to all of that was a once upon a time very, very famous home which she had a hand in designing and constructing. That is an amazing story. Tell our listeners about this particular structure and how central this was to Maria Telkisch's life and mission.
Yes, it is kind of amazing because if you look at kind of the arc of her story, she's experimenting at MIT. She's having, you know, some successes, but ultimately her technologies for what she's really trying to do is store solar so that it can heat a house. And she's having some failures. And when MIT kind of tells her she can't go on with her work, she goes out and she finds a architect named Eleanor Raymond, who was a very sort of recognized female architect at the time. And she finds Amelia Peabody, a woman who was a philanthropist in the area of Boston at the time. And the three of them go about designing and building the Dover Sun House. Maria's vision is that she is building a house that a family is going to live in. And she really wants to build a house that is going to be entirely heated by the power of the sun. And she's building it in Dover, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. So that is not an easy feat. There are cold winters to contend with. So they build this amazing house, and they move a family into it with a three-year-old child. And there's some incredible photographs of, you know, Christmas morning with the family there as they've just moved in. And she really enlists the family to, work the technology of the house and to take measurements and also give tours to the public of the house so that they can see how it works. And I think, that is very much part of her public relations genius, is that she really wanted to show the world that this was something that could really help people and work for people, and that it's not just something that scientists are working on in a laboratory.
Mm. One of the great hallmarks of your film, I think, is that among the people that we hear from is someone who is now a grown adult who was one of the children in that household, of that family, who lived in that Dover house entirely powered by solar energy. And it's remarkable to hear from them. Unfortunately, although things go very, very well at the outset, I mean, the family lives in this house successfully through that first tough winter, and it seems like things are really, really good. Ultimately, things start to go wrong with this home in terms of kind of the mechanisms and so on that allow the solar power to function correctly. And this is a really kind of a sad thing, because there is such great promise, and yet it's sort of promise or potential ultimately unfulfilled, and there is a very, very steep cost to all of that. In some respects, the failure of this particular home, such a high-profile project, in a sense spells doom for the more widespread embrace of solar power. Help us understand how such a thing is possible.
Well, it is true that the solar, the Dover Sun House, ultimately fails. I mean, it works for a couple of years, but she's experimenting with something called Glauber salts, and they ultimately kind of corrode the tins that they're in and start to leak. And so there are problems, and they do eventually install a heater in the house. And so, yes, the house does not fulfill its promise in the end. However, I would say that the forces that sort of pulled the rug out from under the solar movement were really much bigger than the failure of the Dover Sun House. In a way, that was kind of the icing on the cake, or kind of the final straw. But really what happens is that, following World War II, fossil fuels are, basically become accessed in the Middle East, and cheap energy just prevails. And so this sense that we need to think about different ways to live our lives and different ways to work within work with the resources that we have, or focus on how to access the power of the sun, kind of dry up. And all of a sudden we have, just cheap energy everywhere, or quote unquote cheap energy, because there's all sorts of things that are subsidizing that. But I think that in a way is really what kind of took the wind out from underneath this movement. It is particularly sad. And I see it, especially from the vantage point of today, where we are sort of like thinking in a very proactive way, or trying to think in a very proactive way. I look back and I say, we were here before, but then, there was a shift in the economy, in the accessibility of oil, and therefore we sort of dropped the ball. We just said, okay, well, we don't need it anymore. We can drive our cars everywhere. We can, fly all over the place. We can, we can do whatever we want. And all of this was very much fueled by the idea of cheap oil. And so I think that was really the main force that created the failure of the Dover Sun House. And then the Sun House was kind of just a very sad emblem then of that of that new reality.
Hmm. Well, Maria Talkish never pulled back from her energetic embrace of solar. And your film, of course, goes on to talk of everything else she did after being dismissed from MIT, and all of the great work that she did in all kinds of areas involving solar energy, and of course, ultimately now we are coming to a new understanding of her groundbreaking work, and are coming to think more and more about the potential for harnessing the power of the sun in ways that might really change our lives and the world in dramatic ways. That and much more explored in your fascinating film called The Sun Queen, airing tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And director and producer of the film, Amanda Pollack, has been my guest. Amanda Pollack, thank you so much. Congratulations on a terrific film, and thank you for being my morning show guest. It was great to talk with you. Best wishes.
Thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And now an interview from the Morning Show Archives, a morning show interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2019. On this portion of today's morning show, we are going to be talking about what it means to be human and what it means when we live in a world that seems to be bent on dehumanization, at least in many different respects. This is a topic that has been of great interest to my guest, Adam Waitz, who is Associate Professor of Management and Organizations and Social Psychologist at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and the author of a very interesting new book called The Power of Human, How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World, published by W.W. Norton and Company. Among other things, in Professor Waitz's book, he explores what it means to be human and some of the unique characteristics that set human beings apart, characteristics that we often, in a sense, take for granted or do not fully appreciate. For instance, a human being's capacity to persuade others, or the way in which our humanity can lead to very, very deep connections with others. Even in a world such as we live in now, in which there is so much automation that seems to undermine our connectedness. That and much more is explored in this book, again titled The Power of Human. So, Professor Waitz, we welcome you to the morning show. I'm really happy to be speaking with you about your really, really interesting book. Briefly, how long has this particular topic, humans, dehumanization, the rise of automation, how long has this been of interest to you?
Well, this book is the culmination of basically 15 years of research on the topics of humanization and dehumanization, because those are sort of jargony terms. I'll say what they mean. Humanization is really just, in the simplest way, deep social engagement with another person, where you consider the mind behind the eyes of another person, their wants, their dreams, their thoughts, their desires, and their feelings. And then dehumanization is just the opposite, considering another person without the capacity to feel, to think, to have higher emotions, treating them as no different from an object or a subhuman animal. And so I've been thinking about these things for 15 years and thinking that dehumanization has subtly been on the rise and that we should do something about it.
I want to talk about a couple of ways in which we see dehumanization play out. One of the things you say is that dehumanization tends to dominate the stereotypes or the biases that we will sometimes formulate about other people. When you talk about dehumanization in this context, are you really meaning it literally that at the root of stereotypes is a belief that somebody else is not in fact a full-blown human being? Or are you using the term dehumanization in maybe a little more subtle fashion than that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because there's really two forms of dehumanization. The subtle form is more when we overlook another person's capacity to think, when we simply don't notice that there's a real rational, thoughtful person on the other end of the conversation. And then there's the blatant dehumanization that I think indeed forms a lot of our biases and prejudices toward other people. And I think it's also helpful to think about dehumanization not as an on or an off switch where you're human or you're not. We see that it works more like a thermostat, where we often consider other people, particularly out-group members, people we're at war at or people who we dislike politically, as somewhat less human than ourselves. And the reason why we know this isn't just metaphor or talk is we've done some studies where we literally ask people, we show them images of the ascent of man, this famous image that shows how humans have evolved, you know, from Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, all the way up to Homo sapiens today. And we ask people to place different targets on that scale. You know, we ask them things like, where do you think the average American is on this scale? Where do you think the average Muslim is on this scale? Where do you think the average South American person is on this scale? And we actually do see that people will dehumanize certain groups that they dislike using that scale.
In other words, placing them lower on that scale of development. In other words,
exactly.
Regarding them perhaps still as a human being, but a lesser human being, less evolved, less developed, less accomplished, less gifted, or whatever. How about in our current political climate, where you have, for instance, supporters of our current president calling liberals snowflakes, or liberals talking about Trump voters in very kind of sweeping generalization. Is this a form of dehumanization as you are talking about it in your book?
Yes. So I think, as we're all aware, political polarization is at the highest point in recent history, perhaps in American history. And this is borne out in some dehumanization. So one study has actually shown that Democrats and Republicans will rate each other lower in terms of being evolved on the scale that I referred to earlier. In other work, people from different sides of the political aisle don't believe that their political opponents experience the same basic human sensations and emotions that they do. And so you see dehumanization coming out in that way. And in our own work, what we show is something very specific, which is that Democrats and Republicans, if you ask them, why are you in conflict with the other side? Is it out of love for your own party or hatred toward the other party? They'll say, it's out of love for my own party. But if you ask them, well, why is the other side engaged in conflict politically? They'll say, well, it's out of hatred for us, not necessarily love. So this denial of love and this emphasis on hate, I think, is another form of dehumanization as well.
You also talk at one point in your book about something that probably most of us know at least a little bit about, but I really appreciate the detail with which you share some concerns about how dehumanization often occurs within the military, and not accidentally, but there is a purposeful sort of dehumanization that goes on, particularly when it comes to the use of terminology to describe one's enemies. Remind us about that and what kind of lessons we can draw from that that might be applicable in other arenas more directly relevant to the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, so the good news is that humans have a very difficult time harming other humans. Even in the throes of war, it's not something that people want to do. We're very averse to harming others. Now, this doesn't serve us well if the goal is for conquest. So the military has increasingly taken steps to build subtle forms of dehumanization into its training because it's much easier to harm someone if you don't consider them as fully human. That's the disturbing part. So in talking to some military folks, including a very accomplished Green Beret, he talked about how, you know, this even functions in the language that you use to describe the person you're at war with. You don't call them, like by human terms, you call them the target area, or there are terms like mowing the grass. This is someone who was deployed to Afghanistan, and said this term was used to talk about essentially killing younger Afghanis in a way that they wouldn't grow into full-blown terrorists or what have you. So you can see this language gets disturbing very quickly, but its function is to make people feel like they're not, in fact, harming another human being. So that is the tension there. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that in that same chapter, you go on to explore some of the ways in which actually humanization is actually far more valuable in terms of an effective tactic in much of what the military does, and you draw on some real life examples, which completes the picture. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Adam Waitz, Associate Professor of Management and Organizations and Social Psychologist at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and the author of a book called The Power of Human, How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World. I think what lots of people are talking about in terms of your book are the chapters in which you explore what it means to be human in an increasingly automated world. And and much of what you talk about in terms of humanity, dehumanization, humanization really comes into play in some fascinating real-world examples. I wonder if you could share with our listeners a really interesting little story you share that I think a lot of our listeners can relate to, which relates to a trip that you made from Chicago to Tel Aviv for a conference.
Yeah.
And the experience that you had I don't remember if it was the Chicago airport or the Tel Aviv airport, but it really speaks a lot to our current situation.
Yeah, so this was something that struck me a few years ago when I had to travel to a conference in Tel Aviv from Chicago. And from the moment I left my house to, I had to fly through Newark Airport, and there are all these different steps along the way. I realized from Chicago to Tel Aviv, I virtually did not interact with a single human being. So I called an Uber car from my phone. I didn't speak with the driver. I went through some express line for security. I had nobody sitting next to me on my plane from Chicago to Newark. I had forgotten my headphones and bought headphones from a vending machine at Newark Airport. I wanted food, and at Newark Airport, you can order food from an iPad, which I did. Still had no, from Newark to Tel Aviv, had no one sitting next to me. And I made it from Chicago to Tel Aviv and felt like this was one of the best travel experiences ever. No hassle, no fuss, and no humans. And then I started to reflect on that, you know, given all the conveniences we have of iPads and Uber and vending machines and this enhanced technology all around us. And I started to think about, you know, what is lost in a world where we've basically given up interactions with humans to have more convenience and efficiency. And I think there are some things that are lost in our increasingly automated world. Hmm.
One of the points that you make in this section is that this is hitting us hard, this movement towards more and more automation in the workplace. It's hitting us hard because people identify so deeply with their work. Many of us root our sense of identity deeply in what we do and how we do it. And when we find jobs vanishing or jobs being transformed, it can be really, really devastating. And one of your bits of advice is we need to try to, first of all, work less and to base less of our identity on our jobs. I mean, it needs to have a different place in our life.
Exactly. And I think this is somewhat of a cultural belief. I know that this is a strong belief in the United States, that there's this inherent dignity to work. There's this inherent purpose that we get from work. I tell the story about how this is perhaps an apocryphal story, but a non-native English speaker comes to the United States, and he thought the word busy meant good, because every time he asked someone, how are you doing, they said, busy. And so we have this idea that the busyness of our work is an inherently good thing, and our identity is so much tied to our work. But if we step back for a moment, particularly facing the specter of automation, where some of our jobs might not exist in a few years, that idea strikes me as kind of funny, that we derive so much purpose from our work when we could be doing all sorts of other things. And so part of this is to say, how do we deal with automation making us feel potentially replaceable and potentially less human? Well, we should take joy in the fact that humans can do other things outside of work. We can engage in leisure. We can do all sorts of things separate from our worker identity. And I think that's the attitude that I hope we can move toward.
Right. You also talk about how we can think about human-machine partnerships. In fact, you devote an entire chapter to that and explore some of the different ways in which these partnerships might actually work really, really well. Describe your listeners just the sense in which this can happen in several different ways.
Yeah. Well, probably my favorite example, even though it's not the most sexy example, is from cybersecurity. And so the basic idea is, one way I think humans and machines can work together is that machines are very good at crunching a lot of data and doing the same thing over and over and over again. What humans are doing, good at doing, as opposed to robots, is spotting deviations from a pattern, spotting outliers, spotting abnormal information. So these very smart folks at MIT built a system to analyze a bunch of data, online material, emails, and to identify, are there any threats to cybersecurity? Are there any viruses or attacks? And the system, you know, crunches tons and tons of information. This would be too much for a human to take in, or it would take a human a very long time. And when the machine works on its own, it's pretty good at identifying cyber attacks, but it ends up identifying a lot of false positives, a lot of things that it thought were cyber attacks but are really mundane. So what the researchers did is they said, I think we can improve on this. We're going to have the machine crunch millions and millions of bits of data, and then occasionally we're going to give a sample of its findings to cybersecurity human experts. The human experts then say, from that sample, you got a few right here, you got a few wrong here, feed that info back to the machine, and then the human and machine working together are virtually perfectly accurate in identifying cyber threats. So I think, again, even though it's kind of an arcane example, it's a perfect example of how humans and machines working together are often better than either working alone.
Right.
I think there's some hope for the future there.
I also want you to say a quick word about a really intriguing notion you bring up in this chapter about that robots could potentially reduce the emotional burdens that humans face on the job. I think that's very counterintuitive. It's kind of the last thing we would expect a robot to be capable of doing. How do you see that happening?
Right. So the examples I give are at the forefront of customer service. And typically, if you just say the word customer service to people, you know, you don't get a positive response. People don't like calling customer service. Customer service reps are often very burdened. You're dealing with frustrated people. And my personal experience of calling customer service, say, for my cable company or for an airline, is really frustrating because I often need an immediate solution. And I have to go through all these steps online of verifying who I am, talking to a robot, and those systems don't work very well. But newer systems, some systems employed by banks or financial service firms, are using advanced biometric technology that, say, can identify you just from your voice. So if I'm a bank, or if I'm a bank customer and I need to have a secure conversation over the phone, I can call this bank and just start talking, and the machine identifies me. It can perfectly route me to where I need to go, and then by the time I get to the customer service rep, I'm less frustrated, and I'm taking out less of my frustration on them, so they can help me with a more targeted issue. So that's one way that advanced, you know, if you want to call it robots or robotic systems, can reduce emotional burdens on the job.
Adam Waits explores other avenues and arenas in which automation is becoming more and more a part of our lives. For instance, when it comes to self-driving cars, he talks about a study in which he engaged trying to determine how much people would welcome the notion of self-driving cars, and much has to do with how self-driving cars are put together and what level of control the human being in the car can retain. He also talks in his book about how when it comes to automation and the creation of robots, a lot has to do with whether or not those robots begin to resemble us, particularly in appearance. And there is a point at which we do not welcome automation to that level because it becomes a more threatening thing. And that's why the key to automation being welcomed into our lives is when automation does not seem to be aping the human being. For instance, something like a smart speaker in no way resembles a person. And so most people do not have any difficulty with allowing that kind of automation into their lives. It's a phenomenon known as the Valley of Eeriness, in which we welcome the increased sophistication of automation to a point until that automation begins to imitate human beings. And at that point, it becomes too human for our comfort, and we regard it as eerie and creepy and threatening, and then want to reject it from our lives. He explores this and many, many other factors of automation in his fascinating book, and he offers this comforting word at one point. Adam Waits writes, humans will likely stave off automation for longer than predictive models suggest. Machines almost always will be catching up with and learning from humans rather than the other way around. That is, machines need humans. The book, once again, is The Power of Human: How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World. It's published by W.W. Norton & Company, and the author, Dr. Adam Waits. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear my conversation with Pascal Arino, who is Artistic Director of the Racine Symphony Orchestra, talking about the symphony's next performance, which is actually coming up this Friday evening, Good Friday. It will be a performance of a very beautiful and intriguing work by Franz Josef Haydn that actually is very, very seldom performed, The Seven Last Words of Christ. And on Wednesday's morning show, I'm going to be catching up with best-selling author Tom Clavin, who has written a brand new book which talks about the rise of the Texas Rangers and the way in which they helped, in a sense, reshape the Old West. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archive on our website, wgtd.org, or subscribe to The